Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Press Fix Podcast. This is the official podcast of Journo DAO. If you haven't been to the Journo DAO website, go check out journodao.xyz, and you can see what we're all about. With the emerging Web3 technology, we are out there to help equip journalists with the new tools to thrive in this new landscape that we're facing. So today, we are going to talk specifically about some of the things that have been going on behind the scenes in Journo DAO. Sometimes we have interviews with people outside of the DAO, and then sometimes we just talk amongst ourselves. This is one of those episodes where we're going to be talking amongst ourselves and talking about and sharing with you some of the projects that we have been toiling at. And two of those projects are called Seed Protocol and PermaPress. So I will bring everybody up to the stage. We can do some short, quick introductions, and then we'll get to the nitty gritty of it. Oh, by the way, my name is Eureka John, and I'm one of the members of Journo DAO here. And I guess we can start with C Street here, Crystal Street.
Hey everyone, I'm Crystal. This is Cisco, if you see him wandering around. One of the founding members here, background in strategic communications, journalism, and something else. Oh, community building.
Hey, I'm Eric Mack, also one of the co-founders. Spent a few decades as a journalist for a lot of mainstream outlets, and then more recently started doing communications in the Web3 world. Little of both at the same time.
I'm Spencer Cavanaugh. I don't have a professional background in journalism, but I'm a media enthusiast, and I also do some on-chain governance and sort of paralegal work for entities formation and DAOs, the whole world of DAOs. So I'm kind of approaching Journo DAO and the various missions of Journo DAO from that perspective.
Hi, I'm Keith Axline. I'm a former editor at Wired Magazine, but also for the last 10 or so years, a developer, and now working on open source public goods for Journo DAO.
Thanks a lot. And today we're just going to keep it super simple. Some people have an extensive background in Web3 and in the technical space and in software development and all that. But for the most part, a lot of journalists don't. And when they hear the words Web3 or NFT or crypto, they're immediately turned off by one, some of the jargon, and two, just some of the attitude towards the industry of justifiably so, some of the negativity that's come through people losing their life fortunes on things like frog JPEGs and stuff like that. So rightfully so, but we're here to help kind of adjust the narrative a little bit to where we can actually figure out how we can use some of these tools to bring forth some of the truth and keep the truth on the podium in the face of disinfo, in the face of AI deepfakes, and in the face of large corporate ownership and syndication and things like that. So we want to talk about two of the tools that Spencer and Keith Axline here have really been putting a lot of hours into these, and specifically Keith Axline as far as PermaPress and Seed Protocol. And they can go super, super deep, but right now, for the purposes of this first part of this episode, we want to keep it super simple and high level. So we want to talk a little bit about the origin stories of PermaPress and Seed Protocol, how they go together, and what does all this mean here for media? So I guess who wants to start? Keith, you want to give it a go?
Kind of. I'd like to kick it to Eric because he was kind of the impetus for all this, and just his initial problems of like not really being able to control the longevity of his articles and where they were, like how discoverable they were. So maybe we could start there, because that's really the problem that started off this whole journey.
Yeah, great point. Okay, all right, Eric.
Yeah, I got interested in Web3 initially a few years ago, learning about things that were happening with NFTs and new platforms like Mirror that specifically gave writers more control over having like a direct relationship with their audience and like how they could monetize their content, and rather than having to go through third parties, whether it's a company that you write for, like writing for Forbes or working for CNN, or even if you're self-publishing, but you're still turning over a lot of control and autonomy to, it could be YouTube, it could be Substack, it could be TikTok, whatever. I mean, the traditional way that publishing has gone is through some sort of intermediary. And I think we kind of thought, like, with the internet, that the internet was going to like allow this like blossoming of self-publishing and self-control, which it did, but we didn't really kind of take note of the fact that there were still all these intermediaries, whether it was Amazon or Google or Facebook, which subsequently have become the largest companies in history, largely on the backs of being able to take control of all of our content and monetize it for themselves, and then build algorithms on the backs of our content that allow them to further control like the information ecosystem in terms of, we look to Google to literally tell us what the best sources are, what sources on the internet have authority. Like, basically all of the value of all of our collective information as a civilization is flowing through a handful of companies. So it was exciting to see Mirror and other people building on Ethereum and on other blockchains, like kind of building solutions that allow you to take some of that control back. And that's like a very, that's a lot. So like one specific, I guess, use case that we kind of identified in that could, you could actually grab onto as a journalist is the idea of, in the last couple of years in particular, a lot of publications have kind of gone away as the media world has contracted a bit, Vice shut down, Sports Illustrated has ceased a lot of its operations. And in particular, one outlet that I'd done a lot of freelancing for over the last 12 years, one day told me that 700 of my stories had been taken offline and they were still on a server somewhere, but they were no longer on the internet. I was told after the fact. And this has happened to me several times over the course of my career. It's nothing against the place where this happened. It's just kind of the way the business rolls. I mean, outlets can shut down like Vice, or maybe there's an SEO change and your content has to disappear or change. You just don't have control over it. And so like, I've definitely lost access to a lot of stuff that I've written over the years. And, it would be great if there were a way to really truly have control over all the content you've produced in like an easy way, and then could even monetize on the backs of it. So there, there's startups that I'm rambling here, but there's startups that have popped up to do this, to like organize a portfolio for you. But that's like, you're still paying another platform to be a third party intermediary. But like, blockchain seemed to clearly like give the actual creator or the journalist the actual ability to control and monetize the content without the intermediaries, permissionless, as we like to say. And so that is kind of the first use case that we are trying to prove out, and that Keith has been building with Seed Protocol, is a way for journalists to actually put their content and put their portfolios online in a way that they control, and it is immutable, permanent, as long as some blockchain that exists somewhere that the protocol is compatible with. And so maybe that's where you could take it from, Keith.
In my mind, it was even like simpler, as far as like, just, can I have a page? That's how I remember you saying it in your head, where it's just all my stories that like doesn't go away. And that seemed like, the blockchain should be able to do that. Like, if we do nothing else, we should be able to provide that. And so that kind of kicked off the discovery there. And I think several things were happening kind of in parallel, where the Ethereum attestation service was kind of becoming more popular, and we were all kind of interested in it. We weren't sure exactly how it could help, but we just knew there was something there for journalists. And at the same time, I think Farcaster was becoming a thing, and this model of Warpcast being like the kind of for-profit or private, whatever you want to call it, a client for what is actually like an open public network. And this sort of model really appealed to us. And so we started out just with like a basic, like, can we get Eric's stories somehow on the blockchain using Ethereum attestation service? And that just kind of unrolled a bunch of interesting problems and ideas. And we ended up realizing that this was like a much bigger opportunity, I think, than any of us realized. And that's why we kind of went down the seed protocol route, where we asked ourselves the question, like, what is the most minimal amount of structure and opinion that we can put onto content that makes it discoverable and flexible for whatever formats and needs might come up in the future that we can't even anticipate right now, because there's the permanent storage aspect of it, but then there's also just maintaining relevance and discoverability and meaning over time, which are much harder to account for. And so we kind of that's what was on our minds when we started building.
I think one of the hardest things for me to differentiate when I'm learning about this is the difference between seed protocol and then permapress, and that interaction. And I guess, what is a protocol and how is that different from a centralized model, something like, Facebook or something like that? And can you take something like permapress, if you didn't like that interface for some reason, sorry, no offense, Keith, but and move it to some other client that could be built, and can anybody build on the seed protocol? I guess we need to explain all these dynamics of how all that fits together. Yeah.
Yeah, I think email is a good example, where you can bring your email to any sort of client. You can download a bunch of different apps, whatever gives you the features that you want to actually browse and manage your email. But the email service is just handled by a decentralized protocol called SMTP that, as long as the service that you're trying to interface with also follows that protocol, then you can enjoy those like network effects of everybody kind of following the same pattern, which we've seen. And, same thing with HTTP. So you could think of this as like a version of SMTP for content. And then we're just building the first email client so you can actually use it and manage it. There's like a UI that you can make all the operations that you need to on the protocol. But then because those features are so opinionated, we'll be deciding like what you see, like what's priority, like over this, and how do you publish, how do you do this, that really makes more sense to be kind of contained within this app on top of the protocol, where the protocol itself is just open, kind of sitting there, and then anyone, somebody that we don't even know could spin up their own app, and then we could see you know, their content expressed in PermaPress without either team or either party really knowing that the other exists. So I think that's part of what drew us to Ethereum attestation service, is just the network effects already built into Ethereum and trying to leverage that for discoverability and being able to see things that people are publishing and discover cool new things that anyone in the Ethereum like ecosystem can both view and publish into. And I think those network effects make it probably the most appealing ecosystem, although you can certainly follow the same pattern with Bitcoin or really any other blockchain.
So one thing I noticed when I was actually gathering old content, I went into the Wayback Machine to try to find stuff. I originally began publishing in, I think, probably 2006 on Blogger. And then going back into the Wayback Machine and looking at some blog content for a magazine I used to publish with, I noticed how different, like when you would click on the link to see the article from, you know, 2009, everything was broken and you could just barely see little bits of content here and there. So one of the things I love about this technology is it attaches each individual piece of content, like the photo and the title and the body copy, and it gives it its own little tag so that in the future, when the technology has changed and we don't even know what that's going to look like, the individual tag can bring the content into a modern form and not have it look like someone just vomited all over the page, which is what it looks like now when you pull up an old Blogger article, if you can even find them. So that's, for me, that's one of the really big game changers, is that this allows us to adjust for the future of what's to come, as long as we've tagged everything a certain way, which the protocol and PermaPress do on their own.
Okay, so just to be clear, JournoDAO has no stake or ownership of the seed protocol, but JournoDAO would have some kind of stake or ownership over PermaPress. Is that right? Is that kind of how the structure goes?
Yeah, that's what we're thinking, just following the footsteps of other open source private combinations like WordPress and Automatic, or in Web3, you know, Uniswap and Uniswap Labs, or we think that's actually a necessary component of permanence. Without that sort of private enterprise driving the development and the opportunities and the energy behind it, then these protocols just tend to be inert and abandoned, because like their potential is never really like demonstrated or unlocked by private developers. So I think it's, in my mind, it's just about setting the example of like what's possible, just kind of like Warpcast has with Farcaster. But then you can go on Yup or any of these other great clients, and they offer you just a different, it's like same content, but different experience. And that's kind of necessary to give the market kind of a decision of what they value, instead of it's really just Twitter and their experience and what they value, and you kind of take it or leave it. This way there's like a lot of different flavors, a lot of different ways to view all the same content. So nobody can feel, well, I won't say they won't, but realistically nothing is censored, because everything's just on by default. And then it's more about the curation of just the mass of stuff, and chances are if like some app is surfacing something that you don't like, then you can go to a different app or customize that app, or actually have agency in the system that you're working with, which I think we've all, it's kind of shocking that we've gone without it for so long, but I'm excited to actually be able to control like what goes into the content that I see, and have it be about me rather than about the business delivering the content to me.
Yeah, it makes me think a little bit of, you know, I guess in the past when they were building railroads, it was super expensive for a company to take it upon themselves to just lay down railroad tracks, and they didn't want to pay for anybody else to use those tracks. They wanted to own those tracks. But it's not necessarily the case in this digital age. Of course, you've spent a lot of time, and time is money, you know, building this stuff. But the business model now seems to be create some rails, let everybody use it, and then that helps everybody grow at the same time, I guess. It seems kind of like a paradigm shift in way of thinking.
Yeah, to this point about the distinction between a protocol and an interface, or a protocol and an app, is that if we're trying to solve a given problem or set of problems, in this case it's like content longevity or censorship resistance or deprecation resistance of content, like if you think about that as trying to solve that on an app level with a company that needs to stay in business to keep that app up, then we kind of run into a lot of the same problems that Eric was talking about in the beginning, where that company may have like management shifts, or they may have financial pressure or other kind of financial kind of forcing functions that may require them to change how the content is stored, or like delete some of it, like what Twitter did with all the media on posts before like 2014 or something like that, where there's just this kind of misalignment between the like financial imperatives of running a business and keeping a product and service maintained versus kind of playing this public good role of, you know, content storage as a public archive. So it's like if we approach this problem from an app level, trying to solve it just at an app level, like if we just had PermaPress and something like that without any underlying protocol, we would be running into the same issues that we're trying to correct for. So I think that's to John, your point about this paradigm shift and thinking. And granted, like Keith said, it's in emails as well, so it's not that new. There's just some new financial technologies. But trying to solve problems like this at the protocol level, it's like the main perk of that in my mind is that it doesn't require Journo DAO to like stay in business maintaining this thing in a centralized way. Because if this protocol takes off and gets the kind of network effect, like peer-to-peer adoption, then it's something that can and probably will outlive Journo DAO. So I think that's another kind of key distinction between like an app level solution and a protocol level solution, because there can be a variety of apps built on top of C protocol that'll kind of address different audiences or different user bases. So at least that's some of the rationale behind trying to have like an app and a protocol in conjunction with one another here.
So let's explain this to a journalist like they're 5 years old. Because I feel like we still are not explaining this maybe as clearly, because we are so deeply in the tech. So yeah. Exactly why does a journalist care that there's a protocol underneath basically a WordPress? Explain it that way.
Yeah. So at the top level, I think the problems that we're solving are simple. You know, we've been talking to journalists for years and haven't really landed on super simple way to explain what's very counterintuitive and very different than just the way that Web 2 works. So maybe we need to ask the journalists to maybe like give us a little bit of time and space. It's not going to be summed up in like a quick sentence or whatever, but I think focusing on the problem is really how all this stuff kind of spins out as a solution. And it's really just agency and permanence. You know, if giving you control over your content and is actually very difficult in the digital world. I mean, because you can copy and paste things a million times. Like that's why people generally think it's ludicrous to like own a JPEG, because it's just like, well, I can just go and grab it and now I have it. And like this idea of ownership is not or has not been native to like the internet. And in order to kind of get that scarcity and this idea of ownership and to like prove something, because everything can be edited, you know, I can copy and paste this person's article and say that I wrote it, and I can hack into their server and then change like the publish times, and everything's so wishy-washy that we've just kind of become cynics and nihilists about claims made about the internet. And we're like, I mean, this is probably the New York Times, but like, I don't know, like, who knows what could be going on behind the scenes. Like, and so the idea to give somebody actual control, you need cryptography and you need a disintermediation. Like, you, in order for you to have some control there, like Spencer was saying, there can't be a business, there can't be a server, there can't be something between you and the content. And so the best solution that we have found so far is to decentralize things so that, you know, a large number of people who are providing whatever service you need, like, you know, hosting your content, like a huge amount of people can just decide not to, and yet your content remains because there are enough other people hosting that content for you. And that's kind of like the best version of permanence that we have, is as long as there's enough people incentivized to continue providing this service, then it stands to reason that, you know, even if like the US power grid goes offline, there's still distributed people around the world serving that content. And when you do the math of like how much of the network would actually have to go down for you to like to interrupt your service, you kind of realize like, well, we'll have larger problems to deal with, and like whether I can access my content at that point if that much of the internet actually goes down. And so it's really just about like, I want to publish something and I hit the publish button and now it's there until I say it's not. And nobody can say that I can't access that anymore. Nobody can say what I do with it. And I think until we start there from that kind of level of agency, then future businesses and future institutions just have no reason other than like their ethics to deal with us directly about what we do with our content. And until we can do what we want, then only then can like the real services be built on top of it that actually address real needs that people have and not just pre-existing needs of a business that wants to use you as part of its customer base.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit more directly to journalists about this. In addition to everything that Keith just said, and the benefits of all that, I think appeal a lot, in particular to like the freelance journalists. I was freelance, still am a freelance journalist for like the last 25 years. So this idea of like more ownership and control obviously applies directly to freelance journalists, but also to legacy journalism organizations. I think having a level of autonomy and control over content, over publishing is also very important. And I think for generations, for decades, that meant that stations and print outlets, they actually owned their own printing presses. They were like in the basement. They owned their own transmitter. They owned everything, the entire infrastructure. And that's not really the case anymore. And I think in the media, sometimes we're a bit delusional about that. I mean, the reality is that the rails that all journalistic content goes out over right now is controlled by entities like Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Cloud. And these are some of the largest, largest companies in history. And they have some oftentimes dicey interactions with the press. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. So, you know, so far, so good. But I mean, we can imagine some, awkward relationships cropping up where Amazon Web Services and its owner or founder may want to exert some pressure or some anti-competitive pressure on somebody else in the media. I mean, I think there would be checks and balances against that, but you know, it's just not the same. We don't have the same level of sovereignty that we did as media in the past. And it's funny to me because media would never want to grant that level of control to, say, like a government organization over the distribution of their content. But there is a lot of corporate control just in terms of the way stuff is distributed digitally these days. And so this is one way to kind of begin to take back some of that autonomy. And another thing, this pitch that I know it resonates with me and a few other people. I'm kind of surprised it hasn't resonated with a lot more journalists, but with blockchains and with decentralized protocols, there's so much in common in the structure of this technology that overlaps with the ethos of journalism in terms of operating transparently. Everything on a blockchain is designed to be transparent and viewable by the public by design. It's also designed to be permanent, an immutable record of history, which is what the journalism sets out to record, is a record of history. And it's also designed to be censorship resistant, which is something that is hard baked into the ethos of journalism as well. So, you know, I think that this technology actually gives journalism a chance to better walk the talk by baking in transparency so that every time there is a revision or a correction, you know, that gets entered into the immutable record that that is Seed Protocol. And so that I find that really exciting and a way to restore trust in journalism, which is at all-time low. So I think there's just so much here for journalists, really.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, we're entering a time, well, we have been for a while, but now it's really heightened, where censorship is going to be a huge issue. Especially with a lot of the college protests, everything that's happening right now, I don't think people realize, especially journalists, that their servers can be shut down, their .coms can be shut down if they're running through a corporate server or through a U.S. jurisdiction. So if you are a journalist and you have uploaded your content into PermaPress, it technically is decentralized. So it lives on little nodes all over the world. So if something gets shut down in one part of the world, it automatically still exists on all of these other spaces. So that is one of the core elements of decentralized servers that is really, really important for journalists and for dissidents. And then being able to have content that's not attached to a URL, it's attached to a wallet address, a long string of numbers. And what attestations do, the way I like to explain it, and I could be wrong, but it's a good visual, is a permanent sticky note that you slap onto a piece of content that can never be removed. So people can put sticky notes on top of your content to say, oh, they're not accurate, or this happened here, or whatever. But it's still a record that follows that content wherever it goes. So if you publish something and it has all those sticky notes attached to it, then it can follow. There's a train of information that can follow that as it moves around. And as we go through different governments taking over information and the flow of information, we're going to have to get creative. And if a journalist has all of their work attached to a wallet that is completely decentralized, it's like a whack-a-mole. You can smack it over here, but it can pop up in all these other places. So I feel like if we can strip out the technology and just begin to understand this as a tool to support freedom of speech, really. I mean, I feel like Eric's saying, you know, it is completely transparent. There is no way to, you know, to fake this or hack this. So, yeah.
Well, somebody, you know, might say, well, I pay my GoDaddy website and I upload all my blog posts there. Does this mean I get free web hosting now that I can just put up all my stuff and I don't have to pay somebody like GoDaddy anymore? Like, what's the difference?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what's paying for a lot of the internet right now is just advertising. And so we are taking the cost of that and now putting it onto the individual. But there's just this weird thing that happens with network effects, though, because if this network is so valuable because everybody's using it, there will be companies that are happy to like subsidize the activity on that network. So yeah, compute takes energy, which takes money, no matter where it is. But I think we're already seeing a lot of companies that have a lot of stake in the space subsidize the what are gas fees, basically like process your decentralized transaction, pay for the compute. And they're happy to do it because prices are going down. Like they used to be kind of astronomical and they're becoming fractions of a cent, like quicker than I can even keep track of. And their whole business is predicated on the idea that the world is going to be on the blockchain to some degree. And to make that happen, you can't really have people even paying like a very small percent, because our appetite for compute is just going to go through the roof. And so I think it is kind of a technical detail that I'm only recently becoming aware of, but I do feel good about the sponsoring of these kind of hosting fees, because the sponsoring of the fee does not actually entitle whatever company or entity is sponsoring it. It doesn't insert them into the transaction in any way that they can stop it or control it. And so you always have the option to pay yourself, but I do think most people's experience in a very short time will just be very similar to how it is now, where you just kind of go on a website and you do the stuff that you want to do, and either that company or a collection of other companies or some nonprofits or nice individuals or JournoDAO or somebody or all of those can just kind of funnel money into a pool that enables all of this activity that everybody benefits from. So that's actually probably a larger conversation, but for now I think you're right to point that out. But a lot of people are happy to pay to get off of the advertising bandwagon, and it's just such a narrow and specific way to experience the internet. I think that everybody's pretty tired of, and there are so many more business models, experiences, ways to think about people on the internet that we just haven't been allowed to, because advertising just paid for all of the infrastructure up to now. We don't even know what's possible when we don't do that.
There's a really good, I won't say the name of the show because I don't want to give a spoiler, but there's a sci-fi series that I'm watching right now, and about halfway through, and in 2067, the year, basically everything runs on a blockchain. But John, they talked about how like people had stored their memories completely in the blockchain, and they could access them kind of like a Apple Vision Pro, whatever, and see their memories. And if they hit capacity, they would go to look at a memory, and this little woman came on and said, "You're at the end of the blockchain," or whatever, "and you have no more capacity left. Pay XYZ or delete your memories." And some of the population, because of the heat, they're entering this phase of dementia. So if they delete the memories, they're gone forever. It's a really fascinating conundrum of data storage in the future. And then also they're using blockchain as their currency as well. So whoever, and they got it wrong. They got the whole node thing wrong. So I want to write the writers and be like, y'all drop the ball there. Because they really, everything else they got right. It's really fascinating if everything runs on a blockchain one day. But it was a corporate blockchain. So, and then, last plot twist there. There was the guy's neighbor was this underground cypherpunk dude that went onto the dark blockchain to grab the information outside of the corporate and give it back to the guy. And he charged a huge bounty to do that. So. It's really cool.
Well, that brings up a concern that other people might have about everything being public. And I didn't fully understand it, but this one element of just having a wallet on a blockchain, you can think of it as just having like a public private key, and that enables all sorts of control over visibility. You can really just garble your data and then selectively choose who can decode it at any time and for how long. And so I think it'd be good for journalists to understand that distinction of like basically turning your content into just indecipherable blobs, and then those blobs live where they will according to the network. But then you actually control who sees it, when, and under what terms, which is more than you can say right now. Right now, you're relying on the goodwill of a lot of different people and the court system. So I think that's a really exciting increase in agency that I think most journalists are probably not going to be aware of for quite a while, just because we have no intuition or education around public private keys. But once you're on the other side of that, you realize that it's just such a better experience, and it gives you the things you want on the internet that you haven't had, like that control.
I mean, I think that also brings up another concern people might have, which is like, this, maybe this sounds cool, but like, why do we have to get involved with like blockchains and crypto for any of this? And you don't. Like, there are other decentralized solutions out there that that don't involve crypto that I hope succeed. Like the more solutions we have, the better. But like, we, and at least certainly I, are making the bet that using blockchains and crypto makes more sense, because it's actually addressing the like huge elephant in the room of how do we pay for all this, which with all the other decentralized solutions, they're great and I want them to succeed, but we're still relying on some benefactor or like a chain of benefactors to just like somehow keep it going, versus what we do with crypto is try to bake the incentives into it, and then try to come up with a way to pay for things, and then a way to, once you reach network effects, and then money does flow into the system more freely, then you can also address how to spend and distribute that money, versus basically handing over all that control to whoever your benefactor is. So like you could think of like Wikipedia as an example of kind of a pseudo public goods nonprofit that's been going for a few decades now, but is, you know, you're kind of always relying on big money, versus we can bake in those incentives and bake in the economics from the beginning to make the thing more sustainable. This also comes from working in public radio, where half of the job is begging for money, and like we can just get rid of all that and figure out the economics on the front end and in a way where they can be adjusted as needed. Does that seem right, Keith, Crystal?
I think so. And yeah. What comes into my mind is Mastodon. I think a lot of journalists experienced decentralization when people pivoted from Twitter to Mastodon, but it was still run by human element. Whereas in crypto, yes, there's humans running it, but there's also contracts and smart contracts and governance that allows people to vote, and then actions are taken and executed by a smart contract. So there, it becomes permissionless or trustless at that point. Whereas if you're using something like a Mastodon, you can still have somebody that runs that server shut it off whenever they want, or remove access if they don't agree with something. Whereas when you get into more decentralization and protocols and entities that are run and executed by smart contracts and supported by humans, then you have a better, I guess, level of autonomy.
Yeah, and I can see how people might hear what Eric said and not distinguish what I said before, because you're relying on benefactors like in both cases. But I think there is this sort of the primacy of like the right to exit and always pay for your own transaction, I think maintains that autonomy. So even though like the end state of network effects on blockchain might look similar, where there's a lot of entities just kind of like subsidizing or paying for the transactions, you actually have the ability to go and do the same activities that you're already doing and just pay for it yourself. And I think that gives you a lot more leverage than you have right now, where it's like, well, I'm just kind of stuck here on Twitter. Like, I can't just go and have the same experience over here. And so we'll see how powerful that is, but I could see that being the meaningful difference that actually creates more human-centered services on top of this, because there's actual accountability, and the move is not just to capture as many people as possible, because capturing isn't really possible. So then you actually have to make as many people as possible happy if you want them to use your service.
Yeah, I think what you guys are saying is great, and the economic model has shifted. Like I mentioned earlier about GoDaddy, you're paying like what, $15 a month for a year. You have to sign like a year's contract, and then you pay up front in a lot of cases. And the cost is pretty high on a person. Then what if you don't use that website or update that website for the entire year? Then you're stuck paying for that entire year, where in this model, you only pay for the transaction fee of what you upload, basically. And that's just, and depending on the network, but it could be a negligible amount of gas, you know, which is the token you use to upload. And really the people that profit and benefit from it are the infrastructure contributors. And they don't have to be associated with any company whatsoever. It could be anybody that runs a PC at home, depending on the blockchain. But, you know, anybody could contribute and become a node on that in order to process all the transactions and information that go. And those are the people that make the money from it. So it frees up the user, the contributor who wants to publish content, so they can have it in a kind of for free, you know. But yeah, as a public good, like you guys said, all this becomes a public good as a platform.
It's kind of like maybe working for the government, where you're paying back your own salary a little bit, because at any point you can just start running a node yourself. And so even though you're paying gas transactions, a portion of that is coming back to you, as well as other people's fees. And so I think it's just this participatory network really ensures the ownership, because, you know, nothing's stopping you from going on there and being part of the infrastructure yourself.
Yeah. And for the author, it's just pay as you publish. Okay. So we've basically covered protocol, the difference between a protocol and client, and you know, the infrastructure as a public good. Eric, you want to kind of wrap us up here on some of these concepts?
I guess just like one more thing on, you know, kind of the idea of who the benefactors have been that have kind of you know, paid for media infrastructure, particularly in recent decades, in the social media era, where suddenly everyone has become a publisher and we're all competing with everyone else, whether they're professional journalists or they're TikTokers or whatever. In the beginning of the kind of social age, you know, everything was free and is still free. We were just offered these like marvelous services, like free email, free publishing, free everything. And this was all to, you know, build up a user base among these companies. That's how, you know, Facebook got 2 billion users. You make the service free, And then, of course, as the saying goes, if the service is free, that means the product is you, which I think is something most of us didn't realize until we were already too deep into it, including media outlets who had begun to build their business models around social and around Google and around these private party platforms. So they were the benefactors of our modern media infrastructure until it came time to pay the bills and to pay back all that investment, when suddenly everything flipped around. And it went from building and attracting users to now extracting as much value as possible out of those users for shareholders and for continued expansion. And that's like the business cycle that has turned around in the last 5 to 10 years. And that's why I think we're seeing a lot of people like us that are tired of that and that are more interested in media being able to have in journalists being able to have more autonomy. And so when we talk about, you know, the fact that we're still talking about benefactors, that like there's going to be, you know, protocols in the beginning that subsidize what we're working on. So here's the big, like, so how is it different? So how it's different is these protocols and these benefactors that we're working with in the Web3 world aren't necessarily all giant corporations. They're part of a larger community. And so the idea is that the community is subsidizing this in the beginning so that when it comes time, when we reach network effects and the thing becomes sustainable, ideally the community can come together and decide how to distribute those resources to keep building the thing, to sustain the thing, versus just extracting it for shareholders. So that's the vision. That, or at least that's why I'm here. You could point out ways it could go wrong, but I think it is. I think it's an improvement upon the current system. And I think that if we continue to steward it in that direction, that it's an improvement for all of society. So that's all.
That's great. That's a great summary. And speaking of benefactors, if you are Web3 savvy, we do have a Gitcoin protocol, a Gitcoin round protocol going on. I believe there's 8 days left. If you want to contribute to this project, go to gitcoin.co. We're around 42161, and you can contribute. And they use quadratic funding, right? In order, and if you're Web3 savvy, you know what that means. If not, then there's another whole rabbit hole for you to go jump down. But it is a way for people to individually contribute to projects they like. So projects like this won't have to be bowing down to a corporate benefactor. And you can go check out our website as well, journodao.xyz, and you'll kind of get the lowdown on us. And then we have a website for PermaPress. Are we allowed to post that, to talk about that one yet, Keith?
We're allowed. It's just it's a hard hat area. So
it's a hard hat area. That's a good
one. I mean, if it works once, I'd be happy, but it might not work again.
Well, I mean, okay, don't go there and try to use it quite yet, but go read the text on there, and it'll help you kind of understand, you know, what we're trying to do here. So, yeah, it's permapress.xyz. Anything else?
There is permissionless access to the construction zone. Just bring there your own hardware.
Yeah.
Sign the waiver.
With agency comes responsibility.
That's it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
Outro music.